We're going to go to Luke chapter 9 again. It feels like we've been in Luke 9 for a month or two now, but it's been good, right, going through the book of Luke together. And we're actually starting a new series today, still in the book of Luke, but kind of transitioning to a new section here. We've been studying on the idea of who do you say that I am? Jesus was revealing himself to us in many different ways, many different pictures over the last several sections of Luke. And now he's going to start to turn the corner and start to reveal to the disciples and to teach the disciples who they are in light of who he is. What does it mean for us as we follow Jesus? How does that change who we are and how we live and what we do and what we say and how we act and all these things? And we're going to look at that over the next several weeks in these next couple chapters of Luke. And so today we're going into Luke 9, verses 37 through 45, looking at a very interesting story here with the theme of I am delivered. Okay? So here we go. So, these days, prices are absolutely insane. Anybody else with me on this? I was reading an article this week. In the U.S. right now, the average price for a dozen eggs is over $7. That's like more than double what it was this time last year. And so, we were at a basketball tournament this week, and I was staying in a house with a bunch of dads and you know, guys that were on the team, and so they went to Walmart to get stuff, and they brought back like a carton, not a dozen, a carton of eggs, because you're feeding, you know, teenage boys all week. And so we had like three or four left at the end of the week. Like, let's just put these on Facebook Marketplace. We'll like make a fortune right here, just like selling these four eggs. We'll make all the money back that we spent. But no, prices are crazy. So with us, you know, we're a family of five. We got three girls entering teenage years at this point. So things are just getting more and more expensive all the time. And so we're kind of looking for ways to always, you know, kind of save some money, right? Cut some costs a little bit. And one of the ways that we do that is we buy all of our gas at Sam's Club. All right? Anybody else? Sam's Club, Costco, gas buyers in the house today, right? It's a pretty good deal. You can save 20 cents a gallon every gallon that you buy there, just straight off the top. And so so we do that a lot. The downside is the lines, right? Because you have to like get in line. Like some of these people, they'll wait for like 15, 20, 30 minutes, right, to save their money on gas. And so you get in the line, and then you finally get up after you've been waiting for so long. You get up, and you have all these people waiting behind you, right? And so my goal every time I'm getting to the gas pump is, like, I'm going to do this as fast as I possibly can, right? Like NASCAR pit stop. That's what I'm going for here, okay? Like jump out, get it filled up, get back in the car, get going. And so I found that the fastest way that I can get through this process is to use the mobile app, my Sam's mobile app on my phone. I already got my card in there, so my credit card, I don't have to get the wallet out, I don't do any of that. I just jump out, scan, start pumping the gas, right? So I'm in line the other day, pulling up to finally get to the pump. It's my turn, jump out. I'm going for like my under 15 second pit stop here. So I jump out, I go around, I pull up my phone, I pull up the app, and the app has logged me out. And so now I'm standing here at the pump, ready to pump. I got all these people behind me, and I don't have a Sam's card. I don't carry a Sam's card on me. I don't have that. And so I got to log myself back into this app. And of course, I don't remember my password. Who knows the passwords? I mean, for Sam's Club? Like, I use that like never, right? So I'm still like trying to get logged into this stupid app. And all these people are waiting behind me. They're like, who's this idiot? He doesn't even have his app ready, right? And so I'm trying to get logged in. And I finally figure out the password. I put it in. And they're like, okay, we're going to text you a code, right, to verify your identity, because evidently they don't want somebody like getting free bulk items off my Sam's card or something in the store. So I have to verify mine. So they text me the code. And normally I don't care. Like the code's thing, that's fine. I don't care. But at this point, I just need to be pumping gas like ASAP, or like 2 minutes ago, I should have already been pumping this gas. And so I'm waiting for this code and I'm stuck. I cannot go any further. I can't do anything until they deliver this code to my phone so I can put it into the app and finally get logged in and start pumping gas. Without that code, I was absolutely stuck. I could do nothing. Right? Now, that's like us in life. Not Sam's Club and not codes. Okay, that's not what I'm talking about this morning. But there is a stark reality that in this life, we are stuck. And in our story today, we're going to see that this family, this father and son, they are stuck. And their only option of being delivered is one thing. And one thing only, and that is Jesus. Sometimes there's only one option. One option to get where you're trying to go. So today we're going to see in this story that only Jesus can deliver me because only Jesus was delivered for me. Only Jesus can deliver me because only Jesus was delivered for me, as he's going to highlight in our story today. So let's pick up in verse 37. It says, on the next day, when they had come down from the mountain, a great crowd met him, and behold, a man from the crowd cried out, "Teacher, I beg you to look at my son, for he is my only child." And behold, a spirit seizes him, and he suddenly cries out. It convulses him so that he foams at the mouth and shatters him and will hardly leave him. And I begged your disciples to cast it out, but they could not. So let's pause right there. First thing this morning, number one, I need someone to deliver me. I need someone. Someone to deliver me. It starts off in verse 37 and it says, on the next day. So obviously this is pointing back to what just happened, right? So we just studied last week. They were up on the Mount of Transfiguration. They're coming down off the mountain the very next day, right on the heels of this great revelation of Jesus' glory. They come down the mountain, it says, to a great crowd, which appears to have been gathered simply because this one family, this one father and son, were in need of big-time help. They were desperate. They were defeated. Like, this picture of this father and son is the complete opposite of the picture of Jesus' glory up on the mountain. Luke is setting up here a stark contrast from the glory of the mountaintop to the desperation of the valley. And it says here that this boy, Scripture says that he had an unclean spirit, which is another way of saying that he was demon-possessed. And not demon-possessed like the Hollywood movies show you, okay? That's not the crazy stuff, not the scary movie thing, all right? This is like legit. He was completely controlled. His mind, his body, his spirit, controlled by sin and Satan in this moment. He was physically and spiritually captive to this sinful force that was living inside of him. He was stuck in a pattern of life dominated by darkness and struggle and suffering due to sin. Does that sound familiar to anyone else this morning? This is the exact description of us. All of us. We all enter this world with, quote unquote, an unclean spirit. We all enter this world plagued by a sinful nature and sinful flesh that controls us. No, we don't necessarily have a demon possession situation going on. I'm not saying that. But nonetheless, sin, like this demon here, it controls us, it holds us captive, it dominates our lives and our sinful desires and our behaviors. Just listen to the description of this boy's life as the father lays it out. He says it seizes him, it convulses him, it shatters him, and it will hardly leave him. If that's not a description of what sin does in our lives, I don't know what is. We are in desperate need of deliverance, just like this boy. And yet, we see in the story that no one can seem to deliver him. Just think about the list of people here in the story. We start with the boy, right? Himself. Like, he couldn't deliver himself. He can't even control his own body at this point, right? He is powerless to this force inside of him. Secondly, we have his dad, who is at his wit's end. He's begging for help from anybody who will listen. No doubt he has tried everything he can possibly do to help his son. Every parent knows exactly what I'm talking about. He's tried everything at this point. Over in Mark's version of the story, he tells Jesus this has been happening to his son since childhood. So this wasn't just like a new thing. This has been going on for a while. And obviously he can't fix him or he would have done it already. And then there's another group that actually doesn't show up in Luke. But in the same story over in Mark, he also tells us that the scribes were present in the crowd, and they were arguing with the crowd and with the disciples. So the scribes, if you're not familiar, were the Jewish religious leaders of the day, right? They were supposed to be the experts in all things spiritual. So if anybody could deal with a demon possession, if anybody could deal with a spiritual issue like this, it should have been them. And yet they couldn't do anything to help this boy either. And that's why they were more concerned with arguing with them about the problem than they were fixing it. And then lastly, we have the disciples. Now the Father, he calls them your disciples. When he's talking to Jesus, he says, your disciples couldn't help us. So I assume this probably means the nine that remained down at the bottom of the mountain. You know, the three went up with Jesus and nine were down. Right? This is like some kind of weird word problem here. All right. So I think he's talking about the nine that are down at the bottom of the mountain. And despite all the stories of their past power, their past success with dealing with this kind of stuff, with healing people, this time they couldn't do it. Even they couldn't deliver the boy. And so now what? We need someone to deliver him, but no one can. We've all tried, we've all failed, we can't do it, none of us. We all need someone to deliver us. That's what the Father's looking for. So my dad grew up in Memphis, Tennessee. And I was actually born in Memphis myself. We didn't live there, but I was born there. And so we have a lot of like family ties back to Memphis. So it's kind of, you know, a thing in our history. And if you know anything about Memphis, people who love Memphis or grown up in Memphis, they also, if you love Memphis, you have to love the king of rock and roll, Elvis Presley himself, right? Like this is just kind of like part of the package, right? It just comes along with the thing. And so throughout the years, I have heard tons of stories from my dad and others about Elvis and all these things. But this last couple weeks, I was listening to this podcast and I heard a new story about Elvis that struck me. And I was like, oh, that's pretty cool. And so Elvis, he was always known for being super generous, right? That was kind of his thing. Like he was really generous, especially to those in his closest circles and always very giving. Well, there was this story where it said that he went into a city for a show and he had hired a limo service to pick him up, you know, at the airport and take him to wherever he was going. And so the limo service gets there and he asked the limo driver, like, hey, is this your limo? Are you the owner? And he said, actually, no, I drive for a company. They own the limo and I'm just the driver. And Elvis said, okay, well, not anymore. And he calls the limo company and he buys the limo and gives it to the limo driver and says, now it's yours. Right? Which sounds awesome, right? Sounds really great. Until you realize this guy was a limo driver. Probably has no idea how to run a limo business, right? Like how to handle business, how to get clients, how to get anything. And so now he doesn't have a job anymore because he's been bought out from this company. Now he has a limo to pay taxes and insurance and gas on and all this kind of stuff. He has no way to get work. So he's probably sleeping in the limo down by the river because he can't pay rent anymore because he's lost his job. And you're like, yeah, thanks, Elvis. You skipped town. You're all the way to the next gig and I'm sitting here with this limo, right? But that's oftentimes the way we think about our lives. If I can just like get that thing. Right? If I can just get this, if I can just get to this point, if I can just get this promotion, if I can just get this thing figured out over here, then I'll finally have what I need to be the boss, to be on top, to manage my own life, to deliver myself. If I can just be in charge, if I can just get everything figured out, then I can do it. I won't have to depend on anybody else. But it never really works out that way. Now, to be honest, I don't really know what happened with this limo driver. Maybe he was awesome. Maybe he killed it and he's not, owns like a, I don't know, a huge limo franchise across the entire United States. I don't know, okay? It could have worked out great. But here's what I think maybe could have been better. What he really needed was for Elvis not to just buy him a limo, but to hire him to be his limo driver. And to drive him around full time and have that gig, right? Like he needed the relationship with him to really get him through to a better place. And this is how it works with us in Jesus. No matter what we ask him for, no matter what he gives us, what we get from him will never be enough for us to deliver ourselves. We don't need something from Jesus. We need Jesus. We need a relationship. We need an ongoing relationship with the one who can do the delivering. Right? The one who has the power to deliver when we can't deliver ourselves. And so whether we want to admit it or not this morning, I'm telling you, this is true for every single one of us. I need someone to deliver me, and that someone is Jesus. He's the only one. We don't just need a free ride. We need someone who will take us with him so that we can be delivered. So look at how Jesus responds to the Father. The Father's laid out his case, right? And then look at verse 41. It says, Jesus answered, "O faithless and twisted generation, how long am I to be with you and bear with you? Bring your son here." While he was coming, the demon threw him to the ground and convulsed him, but Jesus rebuked the unclean spirit and healed the boy and gave him back to his father, and all were astonished at the majesty of God. Point number two, only Jesus can deliver me. Only Jesus can deliver me. Now, again, picture this. The father is just at his wit's end. He's laid out his whole story. He's been pleading with Jesus. And the first words out of Jesus' mouth are, "You faithless and twisted generation." Ouch, right? Like shots fired. Like, what, Jesus, what are you doing? Like, this guy is like falling apart here. But Jesus, he's using some familiar biblical language to get to the root of what's really going on here. We first see these terms back in Deuteronomy 32, verses 5 and 20. Listen to what he says there. It says, "They have dealt corruptly with him. They are no longer his children because they are blemished. They are a crooked and twisted generation." And then verse 20, it says, "And he said," God said, "I will hide my face from them. I will see what their end will be, for they are a perverse generation, children in whom there is no faithfulness." So Scripture first uses these terms to describe a people who deal corruptly with God, who try to cheat God, and in whom there is no faithfulness to God. They are a faithless and twisted generation, as Jesus says. Later on, Paul uses these terms again in Philippians 2, 14 through 16. He says it like this. He says, "Do all things without grumbling or disputing, that you may be blameless and innocent, children of God, without blemish in the midst of a crooked and twisted generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world, holding fast to the word of life." So here Paul tells us that this generation, this twisted generation, are those who grumble and dispute with God, who argue with God, rather than trust him and trust his word. In other words, Jesus is describing a people who lack true faith in God. Look what he says next. He goes on. He says, "How long? How long am I to be with you and bear with you?" If you've been around our church for very long, you know, you recognize those opening phrases. Those are words of lament. We see them over and over in the Psalms of Lament. How long? He's lamenting their lack of faith in the face of clear evidence that God is present, that God is moving, and they still are faithless. And that lack of faith is the major root issue in this story. It's made even more clear over in the book of Mark and Matthew when they tell the story in their versions at the end of the story. Luke leaves this part out, but the disciples come to Jesus and they ask him, like, "Hey, what happened? Like, we used to be able to do this. Why couldn't we do it this time? Like, what happened here, Jesus? Why couldn't we cast out this demon?" And Jesus gives them two reasons. He says, "Because you had a lack of prayer and because of your little faith." Lack of prayer, meaning you didn't trust God enough to go and ask him for any help. You tried to just do it on your own because you had too little faith that he would actually work in the situation. Little faith and a lack of prayer go hand in hand. Jesus says, in other words, you tried to handle business on your own, and when you couldn't do it, you failed instead of trusting and turning to the Lord who actually has the power to deliver. But I also want you to notice here, his rebuke, this faithless and twisted generation, is not just for the disciples. It's not just for the 12 or even for the 9. It's for the whole crowd. Jesus uses a very broad language here. He's talking to the whole group, right? Confronting a general spirit of faithlessness among the people. He's making it clear this applies to all of us. We're all guilty of this at times, right? Of trying to handle things on our own, trying to do it ourselves. Like, say, hey, God, I got this one. I'll call you next time if I need you. I'm good for right now. I'm going to handle this myself. But this story is a painful reminder that in the end, that never works. We can't deliver ourselves. So Jesus, he says this rebuke, but then he also says, hey, bring your son here. Despite the rebuke, Jesus is still going to help. He's still going to help because of his love and his compassion and his mercy for us. And this is a really important reminder for us as well, even today in our church. You don't have to earn Jesus' help. You don't have to earn it, but you do have to ask. You just have to ask in faith, believing and trusting in him that he will do what you need, just like the Father does here. He asks for help in faith. Now, to be completely honest, if we go over to Mark's version, his faith is there, but it's kind of struggling, right? This is, if you know the story, like this is the scene where he actually, when he asks Jesus for help in Mark, here's how he says it. He says, hey, help us if you can. To which I love Jesus' response. He's like, if you can? Like, it's got an exclamation point. He's like, if you can? Oh, I can. Like, no, what? There's not a question. I can bring it, right? He's like, it's not if I can. He says the question is, it's if you believe. To which then you have the famous response from the Father, right? I believe, but help my unbelief. I have faith, but it's struggling. I believe, but it's getting harder every minute. I want to believe, Jesus, but I'm desperate right now, and it's hard. Help. Help me. Help me believe more. But even with his small, struggling faith, it was enough for Jesus to help. And then he says, bring the boy to me. And it says, while the boy is coming to Jesus, the demon threw him to the ground and started convulsing him and controlling him again. And the picture here is that even while he's coming to Jesus, he's on the way. He's already asked, he's already decided he's coming to Jesus, but he's still walking in darkness. He's still walking in evil. He's still controlled by sin at this point. And yet, Jesus doesn't say, whoa, stop. Go get that taken care of and then come see me, right? He doesn't say, hey, get yourself cleaned up, get yourself fixed, get it all under control, and then you can come to me. No, he says, don't wait at all. Bring him now. While he's still stuck in sin, bring him now. While he's still captivated by evil, while he's still deep in sin, while he is hopeless in this situation without a chance, bring him to me. Jesus says the same thing to all of us. He doesn't tell you to clean yourself up before you come. He says, are you broken? Are you needy? Are you unclean? Are you still falling down every step you take in sin while you're trying to come to Jesus? He doesn't say, wait. He says, come. Come with all of that and let me heal you. Let me cast that out. Let me clean you up. Come tired. Come captive. Come while you're still mastered by your sin and let me deal with it. That's the offer of Jesus. You don't ever, ever have to clean yourself up before you come to Jesus. He will clean. He will help. He will heal. Don't wait. Come now. So the boy comes and says, Jesus rebuked the unclean spirit and healed him. Like only Jesus can do, right? In that moment, he cast out the demon. He cast out sin. He heals his heart. He sets him free. And he'll do all of that for us if we come in faith. Believing and trusting, he will deliver us. And as he delivered this boy, it says they were all astonished at the majesty of God. This is precisely why Jesus came to earth. To deliver us from sin and death and to show us all the glory of God in our hearts and in our lives. His glory came down to meet our need. Think about that. His glory, the glory of God, came down to meet our desperate need for deliverance. You know, I really love like music and photography and movies and like lots of creative kind of things. But one thing I've never really been able to figure out, if I'm just being honest this morning, and this is no offense to anybody in the room, because some of y'all are awesome at this, but I just don't get it, is just like art in general. It's just never really clicked for me. I think it's cool and all most of the time, but I remember when Courtney and I first got together, we were dating and we're in our early years of marriage, like sometimes we need like a cheap, easy, and by cheap I mean free date, you know, and so we would just like go and like walk around the art museum down in Forest Park, and we would be walking through, looking at this stuff and be like, in my head I'm thinking like, I don't get it. I just don't get it. Like we would go like to the modern art area sometimes, right? And I'm like, did we just frame a drop cloth? Is that what we did? Like we just take like a drop cloth from like underneath the preschool easels at a school with 10 different splotches of paint on and just like, you know, making art's kind of hard. Like let's just kind of like, you know, this is tough. So let's just frame the drop cloth and put it on the wall. Is that what we're doing now? Sorry. But that's just like, that's in my head, right? So this is like, I don't get it. Like I actually enjoyed the basement most of the time, right? The part where they had like the old furniture and the old, like that was cool. I'm into that. But the rest, I just didn't understand it. So, but I do appreciate like a really like well-crafted, great painting that depicts something really beautiful. And so this week as I was studying, I came across a painting like that. And it's by Raphael, the least cool Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle. It was this old Renaissance painter. His name was Raphael, right? And this was his very last painting that he did. And it's called The Transfiguration. And this is a picture of it. It's pretty cool. But here's what really struck me about this painting. It's called The Transfiguration. And so in my mind, he should have just painted Jesus and the guys up on the mountaintop doing the thing, right? The glory of God, all of that. And that's there. It's up there at the top. But then down below that, he has this other scene. He has the scene of the disciples and the people, the crowd down below in need of deliverance. And in this painting, he pulls these two stories together to remind us that Jesus' whole purpose was not just to stay up on the mountaintop and bask in his glory, but rather to come down and meet the needs of the people and ultimately deliver them from their sin and from their suffering. He came down to do what we could never do. His glory came down to meet our need. Our need for deliverance. And so it's an important reminder that only Jesus can deliver me. Only Jesus can deliver me. So the miracle is over, but Jesus isn't done yet. Look at the second part of verse 43. It says, "But while they were all marveling at everything he was doing, Jesus said to his disciples, 'Let these words sink into your ears. The Son of Man is about to be delivered into the hands of men.' But they did not understand the saying, and it was concealed from them so that they might not perceive it, and they were afraid to ask him about the saying." Lastly, number three, because only Jesus was delivered for me. Only Jesus can deliver me because only Jesus was delivered for me. That's what he tells the disciples right here. So it says the crowd, they're all marveling at the miracle, right? They're in awe of what just happened. That doesn't necessarily mean that they have faith in this moment, right? They're just impressed. They're entertained by the miracle, right? It's cool. They want to see cool stuff, right? Like all of us do most of the time, right? And so they're entertained by these signs that Jesus keeps doing, but it doesn't mean that they have faith, because in just a couple chapters, in chapter 11, verse 29 of Luke, Jesus will turn around and he'll say to the crowds, this generation is an evil generation, and it seeks a sign, but no sign will be given to it except the sign of Jonah. He's like, y'all are just here, you just want to see signs. You just want to be entertained, but you don't actually believe. He already knew the truth of their hearts. He knew what was really coming for him. Not faith, but betrayal and contempt, judgment. That's what the crowd was going to do in just a few short weeks. And so he turns away from the crowd at this moment, and he speaks to just the disciples. You see that? He says, Jesus said to the disciples, probably just the 12. He says, let these words sink into your ears. So listen up, right? Like, I want you to get this, right? Let this into your thick skulls. That's what my dad would have said. Like, hey, you gotta hear this, right? The Son of Man is about to be delivered into the hands of men. Delivered? Delivered how? Why? By who? Right, he doesn't give any details, there's all these questions, but we can tell that Jesus, he wasn't talking about being delivered by a man, because he uses what we call the divine passive voice here, meaning that he was going to be delivered into the hands of men by God. God was the one delivering him up to death. This was the perfect plan of God for his Messiah. That he will be delivered up to die for us. Again, Matthew and Mark's version gives us a little bit more detail. And they add in that not only will he be delivered up to death, but he will also be raised back to life on the third day. Which is important because we need to always remember that his deliverance to death was not the end, it was actually just the beginning. His death was not a defeat, it was a victory. Because this had absolutely nothing to do with the power or the will of men. It had everything to do with the ultimate power and plan of God himself. He was the one delivering Jesus to die for us. And Jesus was telling them that this was the only way. The only way this whole thing was going to work. The only way that you can be delivered is if I'm delivered up first. And that's why we cling to the gospel. Because every single one of us starts in sin, in rebellion against God, headed for hell, deserving of wrath, in desperate need of deliverance from our sin, and we cannot deliver ourselves. We have no hope, we have no ability. Our only chance is that someone would deliver us. And so God, looking down in his love and in his mercy for us, he sent his only son, Jesus, to come to earth. He was born as a man, lived a perfect and sinless life, and then willingly allowed himself to be delivered up to death. And he died on a cross in our place for our sin, taking the death that we deserved, and he went into the grave. 3 days later, he rose back to life, just like he said he would, proving that he was God, conquering sin and death, and offering us a chance to be forgiven, to be saved, to be delivered from our sin and from an eternity in hell. Jesus' death and resurrection is the only way any of us can be delivered. Because first, he was delivered for us. But then, of course, it says, they did not understand the saying. Even though this is the second time he said it to them in just a matter of a couple weeks, they don't get it because it says it was concealed from them, which I think is a super interesting statement. It was concealed from them. Who was it concealed by? Was it concealed by God? I don't think so. Like, he just told them, like, hey, listen to this guy, right? Listen to what he has to say. Jesus saying, hey, let this sink into your ears. Like, God wanted them to know this, but they couldn't get it. I don't think God was putting on a ruse here. He's not like, hey, listen up, I want you to know this, but I'm going to tell it so you can't get it, right? Like, God doesn't work like that. God wasn't the one concealing this here. Was it Satan? Hardly. You see, Satan doesn't have any power that God doesn't allow him to have. And if God wanted it revealed, Satan does not have the power to conceal it. So how was it concealed? Was it concealed by themselves? Was it concealed by their own sin that was blinding them to the truth? Jesus is saying it very plainly here. This is not a secret code. He's saying it straight up. And they still can't hear it. They still can't see it because they are blinded by their own sin nature. Blinded to the truth. As so many are. As so many of us were before Jesus opened our eyes. It was concealed from them, and it says they were afraid to ask. So again, afraid? Why are you afraid? Has Jesus ever given you a reason to be afraid of him? I think not, right? He's been nothing but awesome. What are they afraid of? They're afraid of the same things that we're afraid of. The same reasons that we hesitate and stop and don't come to Jesus when we really need his help. Because of pride? Because we're afraid we're going to look weak or helpless or bad to others? And so we're afraid to come to Jesus because of our pride? Or we're afraid because of rejection? Because we don't really know or believe that Jesus will answer, that he will respond, that he will help us if we ask. And we're afraid of that rejection, that getting our hopes up and getting them bashed on the rocks, and so we don't come to Jesus and ask. Or maybe like the disciples here, it's fear out of simply a lack of faith. Simply, I just don't have enough faith to actually believe that if I ask, Jesus will answer. And it stops me from coming and asking for help. Coming to Jesus. Now, of course, I think it's always important for us to remember we probably need to cut the disciples a little bit of slack here because, like, they didn't know what we know. right? They're on the other side of the cross here. They didn't know all that was coming. We have the benefit of looking back and knowing the whole story. I think if they knew what we knew, they would not hesitate at all to come to Jesus, right? I don't think they would doubt Jesus in the least, and therefore neither should we. We know who he is. We know what he's done. We should never be afraid to come to Jesus. You can be delivered. Just ask with faith, not fear. Today, whatever it is you're struggling with, whatever it is that you're falling under, that you're failing in, that you're afraid of, all of it, you can be delivered from all of it if you'll come and ask in faith and not fear. Because only Jesus can deliver me, because only Jesus was delivered for me. It all hinges on that. And this goes for every single person in the room today. Please listen. No matter how you came in today, whether you were already a believer in Jesus or whether you're not yet, this applies to you too. If you've never put your faith in Jesus and trusted him to save you from your sin, you can do that right now. Today, in this room, in this moment, you can be delivered from a life of sin and shame and suffering. You can be delivered from this unclean spirit of sin that's living inside of you. You just have to ask in faith. Just pray and ask Jesus to save you. And if you're already a Christian, if you're already a follower of Jesus, this applies to you too. And here's how. You see, Jesus, hopefully you already know this, but Jesus doesn't just deliver us once for all, right? And then we never struggle with sin again. We never struggle with any issues in our life again. Everything's perfect after that. That's not the way it works. Amen? Because our sinful flesh still lives inside of us, and this broken world still lives around us, and it entices us back to sin over and over and over and over again, day in and day out. So there's times where even as believers, we need Jesus to deliver us again. You see, when you get saved, you are immediately delivered from the penalty of sin, meaning you will have eternal life with God, period. But we are not yet delivered from the power of sin. It's still very much just present and active in our lives and in this world, which means we're going to fall. We're going to fail. We're going to sin again. But the promise of Jesus is that the moment that you do, you can turn and immediately come back to Jesus. He is saying, come back right now. Don't wait. Don't clean yourself up. Don't get your life together. Just come to Jesus. And he will heal you, and he will deliver you, and he will help you again and again and again and again. Every time. Lay down your pride. Lay down your shame. Lay down your fear. Come to Jesus. And you will be delivered.